public works shape a city for generations. Some public works, most notably the great bridges and highways that open new areas to development and ensure that these areas will be developed on the low-density pattern fostered by highways as opposed to the high-density pattern fostered by mass transportation facilities, shape it for centuries, if not indeed, forever. During Moses' reign over public works in New York, a 34-year reign that not only was significantly long in a city that had, after all, existed as a consolidated entity in its present governmental form only since 1898, but also occurred at the most crucial point of time in the city's history, the decades during which its vast open spaces were filling up and being shaped on a significant scale. It was not the shouts of the people, but the whispers of banks, labor unions, insurance companies, big construction combines, big business, and, of course, the retainer regiment that determined what public works would be built in New York. He centralized in his person and in his projects all those forces in the city that in theory have little to do with the decision-making process in the city's government, but in reality have everything to do with it. And by such centralization, he made them strong. What were all these forces? Economic forces. Money, whether in the form of bond underwriting fees, overtime-loaded jobs, rents from huge apartment developments, contracts, increased department store grosses, or any of the hundred forms of the payoffs called fees. Under the system as it had existed before Robert Moses, these forces had been present in the decision-making process, but had been to a degree subordinated to the force supposedly supreme in a democratic system of government. Moses mobilized these forces, whipped or enticed them into line behind his banner, so effectively that they and they alone were the forces that mattered, the forces that determined how the city would be shaped. He mobilized economic interests into a unified, irresistible force, and with that force, warped the city off its democratic bias. During his decades of power, the public works decisions that determined the city's shape were made on the basis not of democratic, but of economic considerations. During most of his reign, the post-LaGuardia portion of it, the city's people had no real voice at all in determining the city's future. He and he alone, not the city's people, not the government officials the people elected to represent them, not the power brokers who dominated some of these officials, decided what public works would be built, when they would be built, and to what design they would be built. He was the supreme power broker.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
This is Audible.
The Power Broker. Robert Moses and the Fall of New York. By Robert Caro. Chapter 34. Moses and the Mayors. O'Dwyer. The best proof that, in the fields Robert Moses had carved out for his own, he and he alone had the final say in New York City is his relationship with the post-war mayors of New York under whom he served. William O'Dwyer, brawny, blue-eyed, and from Bohola, County Mayo, had an Irishman's brogue, an Irishman's gift for blarney, an open, friendly, bluff Irish manner, a wonderful Irish grin, and what seemed like a typical bright Irish success story. Born in 1890, one of 11 children of two impoverished schoolteachers, he went to the Jesuits in Spain as a lad to study for the priesthood. Then, deciding he didn't have the calling after all, took passage to New York and worked his way up. Handyman, deckhand on ocean freighter, stoker and fireman on riverboats plying the Hudson, longshoreman, hod carrier who at lunchtime would read novels to the other hod carriers. Little did the boys know that I was practicing my pronunciation. Plasterer's apprentice, bartender at the Plaza Hotel, cop, dissatisfied cop. When a guy gets along in his 20s, he begins to get uneasy. People stare at themselves, and know that they'll be sore as hell at life at 60 if they don't do something to improve themselves. Cop who studied law at night for 7 years, then, finally, at the age of 35, a lawyer, then magistrate, county court judge, district attorney, brigadier general, and President Roosevelt's personal representative to the Allied Control Commission in Italy. But flickering beneath that brightness were strange shadows. There was O'Dwyer's connection with James F. Moran, a florid, ham-fisted giant with underworld connections, an association that went far back in O'Dwyer's past, how far, no one was ever to learn. When O'Dwyer became district attorney, he made Moran his chief clerk, put him in charge of key investigations, and a policeman assigned to the DA's office. And there were people who, overhearing Moran and O'Dwyer talking together, sometimes came away with the funny feeling that the DA's clerk was giving orders to the DA. There was the fact that although O'Dwyer made his reputation as a DA crusading against Murder Incorporated, he never even called in its kingpin, the notorious Albert Anastasia, for questioning. There was the mysterious disappearance from police files of certain wanted cards and arrest sheets, a disappearance that forced detectives to release a waterfront hoodlum who was reportedly willing to testify that Anastasia had murdered a dock worker who had dared to speak up against him at a union meeting. And there was the discovery of the hoodlum's body in a river shortly thereafter. And there was the sworn testimony of a police sergeant that the files had been removed on Moran's orders. There was the mysterious death of Abe Kid Twist Relis, another mobster reportedly willing to testify against Anastasia, who was killed when he hit the sidewalk 6 stories below the window of a hotel room in which he was being held in protective custody by 6 policemen under O'Dwyer's orders. There was the fact that before O'Dwyer received the 1945 mayoral nomination, he paid visits to 52-year-old philanthropist Frank Costello, born Francisco Castiglia, ruler of the Eastern Underworld, at the Mafia Don's apartment, and there was the fact that contributions for O'Dwyer's mayoral campaign were solicited by a Costello henchman. And there was a fact even more puzzling, a fact known only to a handful of intimates. Under New York election law, a man nominated for office in a primary election cannot thereafter decline the nomination unless he is subsequently nominated for a judgeship. On the very day in 1945 on which O'Dwyer received the mayoral nomination for which he had been working for 4 years, he suddenly begged Democratic leaders to allow him to decline it by nominating him for a judgeship instead, an appeal that the leaders thought was a joke until he repeated it almost frantically, and they realized, to their astonishment, that he was in dead earnest, an appeal that even intimates could not explain, for apparently not one of them conceived at the time of one possible explanation, that the glib, smiling Irishman was being torn inside by the conflicting claims of ambition and fear, that, driven by the ambition to seek the mayoralty, he might at the same time be desperately afraid of what the spotlight in which a mayor must walk might reveal when it shone on those shadowy places in his past. As mayor, O'Dwyer impressed even the most cynical of observers as anxious to be a good one. He had a real love for New York. Years later, living in Mexico City, in what he defiantly insisted was not exile, he would sit for hours listening to Broadway show tunes, talking endlessly of the city he had left behind. Lovely, dirty, naughty New York. Oh, that great big New York up there. Thank God I've got those memories. Most of the time I can't get New York out of my head. He had the qualities to be a great one. Powers of intellect and decision, intimate knowledge of the city, capacity for hard work, sophistication about the powers of the office and their use, and an immense popularity, fueled by an instinct for public relations. During and after the election campaign, many of the rumors about O'Dwyer's past were repeated publicly by his opponent, Judge Jonah J. Goldstein, and confirmed by a Brooklyn grand jury, but O'Dwyer shrugged off the charges as political, and neither press nor public took them seriously. He wanted to be a great mayor, to do things for the city he loved, and Moses, dazzling him with his plans, slapping down on his desk solutions to the city's problems, convinced him that it was only through Moses that those things could be done. O'Dwyer's relationship with Moses started out as a close alliance. Hardly had he been elected when the city's Pandora's box of troubles, held shut during LaGuardia's last term only by a world war, sprang open. The civic leaders who obtained pre-inaugural audiences impressed on him the need for new schools, hospitals, libraries, sewers, and subways whose construction had been deferred by the war and by the pre-war Moses monopolization of the city's resources. Idlewild Airport was barely a quarter finished. LaGuardia's runways were sinking rapidly back into Flushing Bay, necessitating a mammoth reconstruction job. There existed, of course, a post-war construction program completely outlined and, to a large extent, planned in detail by the Moses-controlled City Planning Commission. It was deposited with O'Dwyer by a Triborough messenger the morning after the election. But the program carried a price tag, $1,565,000,000. O'Dwyer asked Budget Bureau experts to find out how much money he would have available to build public works, and disbelievingly heard the answer. None. Thanks to the wartime moratorium on construction, the city could borrow about $150 million before bumping up against the state-imposed debt limit, but the interest and amortization on such borrowing would have to be paid out of the expense budget, and under the current budget, an austerity wartime budget at that, the city's revenues were already $6 million short of its $763 million of expenditures. There was no sign of any immediate substantial increase in revenues, and expenditures could not be reduced. Almost $500 million represented salary paid to city employees. Almost $200 million service on already existing debt piled up layer by layer, not only by Tammany crooks, but by Moses' vast public works, which he had said repeatedly were not costing the city a cent. Approximately $700 million was, therefore, as good as already spent. The budget requests already submitted by city departments would raise the budget by $153 million if they were granted. When O'Dwyer first heard these figures, he was to say, he sat stunned. And, Budget Bureau experts told him, they hadn't yet talked about subways. In the current fiscal year, every ride a man, woman, or child took, for the charge of a nickel, cost the city 6.3 cents, and the subway deficit was more than $50 million. Next year, thanks to rising expenses, every ride would cost the city 6.7 cents, which would raise the deficit to $78 million. At that very moment, moreover, the militant Transportation Workers Union, whose president, Mike Quill, had hired the mayor's brother Paul as counsel, was demanding a huge salary increase. If O'Dwyer was not to be branded as the mayor during whose administration New York City went officially bankrupt, new taxes were needed, and they were needed fast. But the city could not impose new taxes without permission from the state, and the state's governor and legislative leaders, Republicans and up for re-election in 1946, were more interested in embarrassing than assisting him. The situation had wilted even the hardy little flower. It staggered O'Dwyer, who had limited administrative experience, none in dealing with citywide problems and with Albany. Talking to a visitor in Mexico City years later, he would say, "I tell you, there were times when, as mayor, I truly wanted to jump. You would look out over the city from some place high above it, and you would say to yourself, 'Good Jesus, it's too much for me.'" Then, even before O'Dwyer's inauguration, Moses appeared with a proposal. It listed public works projects which could be deferred, and it spelled out methods of paying for those which could not. The city didn't have any money for new housing, but the state did, a leftover $80 million from a pre-war $300 million housing bond issue. It would be simple to persuade the upstate Republicans who dominated the legislature to release that money to the city housing authority. Just remove the liberals who now dominated the authority and who wanted to give away housing to the poor, loading it down with frills that they would not appreciate, and turn the authority over to right-thinking conservatives who could be counted upon to see that housing dollars provided what housing dollars were supposed to provide, and nothing more, a roof over the head of people too lazy or ignorant to provide one for themselves. The current capital budget included $41 million for Idlewild Airport, a Moses planned project whose construction he had been directing. It would be simple to free the city from that expense, and from the additional $200 million it might take to complete Idlewild, turn it over to a new public authority that could raise the money by selling its own bonds. Most important, $425 million of the city's debt limit had been incurred for the subway. In calculating the city's debt, the state did not include self-supporting projects. Therefore, if the subways could be made self-supporting, the $425 million could be lifted out of the constitutional debt limit, and the city would have $425 million more to spend on public works. And the way to make the subways self-supporting was simple. Raise the 5-cent fare to 10 cents. The last two of these measures would give the city additional borrowing capacity to raise funds for public works. And, Moses said, it would be simple to finance the amortization and interest on such borrowing in the expense budget. Just raise taxes. He had a list of proposed new taxes and the resultant revenues already worked out. And when O'Dwyer asked him whether or not Albany would approve such new taxes, Moses told him not to worry, that if he accepted the proposal and gave him authority to negotiate on the city's behalf, he would take care of Albany. Moses' proposal was a fiscal codification of his philosophy and his lust for personal power. Since a greater proportion of the poorer classes, rather than upper, rode the subways, doubling the fare was a financial burden that would fall heaviest on those of the city's people least able to bear it. Moses' taxing proposals left real estate taxes unraised and income taxes unmentioned, these being taxes that would adversely affect big real estate holders and the city's wealthier citizens, whose welfare Moses equated with the welfare of society. Instead, he proposed doubling the 1% sales tax and imposing a 5% tax on all monthly telephone, gas, electric, and other utility bills, as well as on admissions to all places of amusement in the city. Three regressive taxes that would fall heaviest on the city's poorest inhabitants. And the new projects that could be financed as a result of this income would be his projects. The projects, he told O'Dwyer, could be deferred included scores of schools, public libraries, hospitals, and health centers, not to mention firehouses. The non-deferrable list included his proposed new highways. Every one of those huge roads would go ahead on schedule. And there would, at least by some accounts, be a more direct increment to his power, too. According to these accounts, Moses had an associate hint to O'Dwyer that the easiest way to get state money for the Housing Authority would be to appoint as its chairman an official with close ties to the legislature, namely Robert Moses. Equally important, a threat to his power would be removed. The Port Authority, whose surge for power he had stemmed for a decade at the city's western shore, had seen in the city's inability to finance airport construction a chance to breach his defenses at last by taking over the city's airports. But, O'Dwyer was to recall, Bob Moses represented to me that under no circumstances could I go along with the Port Authority. And under Moses' proposal for a new airport authority, he wouldn't have to. Liberals were outraged by Moses' tax proposals. Municipal extortion from those who were not in a position to carry such a burden, one called them, and by his proposed fare increase, because it would be regressive, because the 5-cent fare, low enough to allow even the city's poor to use subways not only to get to work, but to travel to cultural institutions and amusements, was, as Stanley Isaacs put it, the city's greatest single unifying influence, and because the break in the previously sacred 5-cent barrier would establish a dangerous precedent. Operating and maintenance costs were obviously going to keep rising as already old equipment grew older and TWU salary demands rose. Were the subway riders to pay for every rise? If they were, they would soon find themselves spending a totally disproportionate amount of already tight budgets just for the privilege of traveling around their city. Not only would Moses' proposal dump a new burden on the poor, the burden would be heavy indeed. More than half of those living here have a family income of less than $3,000 per year, many less than $2,000 per year, Isaacs pointed out. If two members of the family were working, it would cost them $60 a year more just to get to work. Isaacs, a wealthy, educated Jewish aristocrat, but a product of a home in which the feelings of those less fortunate were considered nightly at the dinner table, understood, as Moses did not, what $60 a year meant. "This is a heavy load," Isaacs wrote the Herald Tribune. "It just cannot be met in many cases without cutting the food budget, without providing less milk for the children, depriving them of needed clothing." Isaacs, moreover, understood the real motive behind Moses' proposal. The coordinator was claiming that he simply wanted to make the subways self-sufficient, the councilman said. But this was not the truth. Commissioner Moses really gave the case away when he explained that he wanted the subways made self-liquidating so as to release $425 million from the debt limit, so that the city can spend a very substantial part of this huge sum on new express highways, throughways, and bridges for the motorist, who will not be asked to pay a penny toward the capital cost. These highways are furnished him free of charge. The unfairness of this seems obvious to me. More important, who would benefit from highways, throughways, and bridges? The same upper and middle classes, suburbanites and the two-thirds of the city that could afford to own an automobile, the same classes which, under Moses' proposal, would be freed from supporting the subways through their real estate taxes. The city's wealthier classes, its car-owning classes, would be subsidized at the expense of the poorer classes. If you insisted on increasing the subway fare, at least spend the money from the increase on subways. With $425 million, you could, in 1946, have modernized all moving equipment on New York subways and made possible the construction of comfortable modern stations. You could, in addition, have sufficient left over to build the more urgently needed new lines. Spending the money from the subway fare on highways would compound the inequities already existing in the city's transportation setup. It was neither fair nor just. Isaacs and other liberals were also distressed by Moses' airport financing scheme. Noting that, to offset the lack of other revenues, Moses had suggested that the proposed airport authority be allowed to pay interest rates almost 50% higher than the port authority, or the city, would have to pay, they assailed his scheme as a giveaway to bankers. And they knew whose money it was that was being given away, the city's people's. The rates Moses was proposing would raise the interest costs, the banker's profit, close to $70 million above what the port authority or city would have to pay. As it happened, the city had sunk almost precisely that amount into preliminary work on Idlewild and would therefore be subsidizing by that amount any authority that took it over. Why, they demanded, could not the port authority be allowed to take it over, on condition that it pay the city back, over the years, the $70 million? The liberals' objections were echoed by LaGuardia, who had resisted similar Moses proposals for years. The sales tax had been imposed only as an emergency measure to finance depression relief. LaGuardia had been determined to remove it as soon as the war ended. Realizing that Moses' airport plan would turn over even his beloved LaGuardia Airport to a public authority, LaGuardia attempted in his first radio broadcast after O'Dwyer's inauguration to teach his successor what he had learned, too late, about authorities. "You'll find that each is a super-government, a wart on your neck," he warned O'Dwyer. "The investment bankers get to be greedy on authority bonds," he said. "Bankers were in control when I took office in this city. They can come back a little at a time. Don't do it." The liberals' fears were echoed by at least one high city official, Comptroller Lazarus Joseph. And Joseph added a point that Moses, in his detailed analyses of city finances, had somehow failed to mention. The state, which at that time took from the city each year far more in taxes than it returned to it, had a surplus, due to the wartime moratorium on construction, of $570 million. Why could not Governor Dewey and the legislature ease the city's financial bind by simply giving some of that surplus back? Democratic legislators repeated the question, pointing out to O'Dwyer that while he didn't have to run for re-election in 1946, they did, and therefore did not want to be identified with a tax and fare increase, they demanded that the mayor throw his prestige behind the demand for more state aid for the city. Moses' answer was, reportedly, to the point. He threatened, as one reporter put it, to reveal some facts that would greatly embarrass the Democratic legislative leaders. The leaders' response was prompt. They swung into line, and, in a naked display of power during a closed-door party caucus in Albany, they whipped other Democratic legislators into line. O'Dwyer did not throw his weight behind the demand for state aid. As for Comptroller Joseph, he had no influence with the men who mattered in Albany, Dewey and the Republican legislative leaders, and Moses did. O'Dwyer gave Moses the authority he had requested, the authority to represent him, to represent the city, in the financial negotiations in Albany. And although the comptroller had been elected by the city's people as the city's chief fiscal officer, at the very moment at which he was appearing before Senate and Assembly fiscal committees on the third floor of the state capitol, Moses was closeted secretly on the second floor, working out his program with Dewey and State Comptroller Frank C. Moore and the legislative leaders, who, with Dewey, controlled the Senate and Assembly. O'Dwyer himself never went to Albany. There are those close to him who believe that during the negotiations, which took weeks, he never spoke to Dewey, even over the telephone. The city's mayor transacted the city's business entirely through a broker, Robert Moses. Moses was the broker, the middleman, between the mayor and the governor, between the city and the state, between Democrats and Republicans. The deal worked out was the deal the broker wanted. The program that resulted from the negotiations, a program announced in February 1946, only after an appropriate public show of efforts to find other solutions and to psychologically prepare the public for the load of new taxes that was to be dropped upon it, was, by and large, Moses' program, although the stories on the maneuverings leading up to final adoption that ran day after day in the city's newspapers scarcely mentioned his name. Moses even played the traditional broker's role of concealing from his principal facts which might have made him pull back from the deal the broker had arranged. Many astute political observers were sure that election year public reminders from O'Dwyer of the obvious dichotomy of the huge state surplus obtained from city taxes and a huge city deficit would have forced Dewey and the legislature to make the contribution to the city that Joseph wanted. Some of these observers even believed that Dewey and the legislative leaders were prepared to make such a contribution when Moses arrived in Albany. But Moses did not represent their position to O'Dwyer in this way. He informed the mayor that his conversations with Dewey and the leaders had convinced him that they would never make such a contribution, and that if O'Dwyer tried to apply public pressure to get it, the only result would be to make them refuse to accept the overall city program. O'Dwyer had no way of checking Moses' information. He never applied that pressure, never backed his comptroller's campaign. In the interests of his deal, Moses misrepresented it not only to his principal, but to the public. Fearing public reaction to the fare increase, Dewey apparently entered into an agreement to delay its announcement until after the election, and Moses lulled the public into a false sense of security by stating flatly that if the sales tax was increased, the fare increase would no longer be necessary. On other issues, too, he beclouded and misrepresented the facts, so successfully that, despite reams of press analysis, the full details of the concealed arrangement were never revealed. He may not have been an honest broker, but he was certainly a discreet one. And, like any broker, he collected a commission, paid in the coinage, power, that he coveted. A huge commission. During 1946, Albany gave Moses, in addition to the new city taxes whose revenue he could spend, and in addition to the promise that the transit debt would be permanently removed from the constitutional debt limit so that he would have $425 million more to spend, the necessary approval for his takeover of Ole Singstad's tunnel authority, for an increase in Triborough's bond issuing powers to $360 million, for the right to pay interest on those bonds to bankers at the rate he wanted, and for the creation of a New York City airport authority. Concerned about the power he was amassing, the legislature drew the line at allowing him to become chairman of the City Housing Authority, but it authorized the authority's reorganization along the lines he wanted, lines that would eliminate his liberal enemies on it. And it gave the reorganized authority $80 million. There was even a bonus on top of the commission. On February 19th, the same day on which the city-state deal was finalized, Moses, who was not even mentioned in the news stories about that deal, announced, in an apparently unrelated development, it was to keep reporters from spotting the relationship that Moses, not Dewey, made the announcement, and that the announcement was released not in Albany or New York City, but at Moses' Long Island headquarters, that the state had authorized $22 million worth of state park and parkway projects on the island, including an 8,200-seat Jones Beach Marine Theater for huge outdoor stage extravaganzas that Dewey had earlier dismissed as an attempt at grandiose empire building. Moses got what he wanted, Dewey what he wanted. Enabled to hold on to the state surplus, he was able to cut state taxes. As part of the deal that Moses engineered, O'Dwyer even praised Dewey's fiscal policies publicly. Dewey won re-election by 687,000 votes. What the city's people got was four new taxes on their heads, plus, although they didn't know it at the time, a subway fare increase. And their resentment was reflected in the unprecedented meagerness of the Democratic vote in the city in November. Even Herbert H. Lehman, running for United States Senator, was defeated in the Republican landslide. But their resentment couldn't touch the man at whom it should have been aimed. O'Dwyer would not be running for another 3 years. As for the man really responsible, middleman Moses, his fate was beyond the people's control. Even if they had known his role, they would have had no recourse against him. Following his re-election, Dewey gloated that his majority was the largest in the history of the state. The boast was not true. The largest majority had been rolled up, in 1934, against the man who had engineered the deal, on the single occasion in his long career on which that man had submitted himself to the people's verdict. Their smiling new mayor had gotten what he wanted, of course, and he was grateful. "Mr. Moses has been very helpful in this matter, and has gone to a lot of trouble to do things for me he need not have done," O'Dwyer said. "He's done that because he's recognized my plight." The depth of his gratitude was demonstrated at his inauguration, at which Moses, being sworn in as the park commissioner and member of the planning commission, drew the heartiest applause from the audience. The first official to be sworn in, as O'Dwyer's deputy mayor, was Moses' man George E. Spargo. O'Dwyer let Moses know that when the housing authority was reorganized, its new chairman would be the man Moses had recommended, Major General Thomas F. Farrell, a former state DPW engineer who during the war had directed all Army construction in the China Theater, including the famed Burma Road. And when the airport authority was formed, O'Dwyer's gratitude was demonstrated even more convincingly. "I've put it all in your hands," O'Dwyer told Moses. "Pick your members." Moses picked them without consulting the mayor. When he telephoned O'Dwyer and told him he was ready to bring them down to City Hall, the mayor told him to come ahead. He didn't even ask who they were. He didn't know their identity until Moses ushered into his office Harry F. Guggenheim, Lawrence S. Rockefeller, and Lieutenant General James H. Doolittle. Guggenheim had been selected because Newsday, the newspaper his wife had founded, was becoming a potent political force on Long Island, and Moses wanted him drawn into his orbit. Rockefeller was selected because he was a Rockefeller. Doolittle, a hero of the Tokyo air raid, was selected for window dressing. And then the mayor simply offered his best wishes, ordered his secretary to bring a Bible, told his press secretary to call the photographers and reporters, and swore the three men in on the spot. After the swearing-in, moreover, he kept Moses in command. "I never spoke to Rockefeller, I never spoke to Doolittle, and I never spoke to Guggenheim," the mayor would recall. "All conversations were had away from the office, between them and Bob Moses. I never talked to them." As for the renamed Triborough Bridge and Tunnel Authority, here is the transcript of O'Dwyer's conversation with a researcher for the Columbia Oral History Research Project about the mayor's appointment of George V. the Fifth McLaughlin and Queens realtor Charles E. Meyer to serve with Moses on the board. Question: could you tell me how you determined that these two men should be selected? O'Dwyer: on the recommendations of Mr. Moses, who knew more about it than any man in the state of New York. Question: why did these men want these posts? O'Dwyer: I don't know. Question: you don't know, but that's how you determined the filling of the posts? O'Dwyer: yes. Policy-making posts in other key agencies, ostensibly unconnected with Moses, began filling up with Moses' men. Question: there are so many positions to be filled. How do you find qualified men? Who presents their names? O'Dwyer: I don't know, except that the names would come in. Moses did a lot of it. The new mayor's gratitude was demonstrated more convincingly still when he not only named Moses chairman of the mayor's emergency committee on housing, but allowed him to name almost all the other members. "We give him about 6 weeks," in a Tammany administration, the Herald Tribune had said. Within 6 weeks after that administration had taken office, Moses possessed not only more titles than he had ever held before, the construction coordinatorship and the chairmanship of the Emergency Housing Committee, added to his chairmanship of the Triborough, Jones Beach, and Bethpage authorities and the State Council of Parks, his presidency of the Long Island State Park Commission, his membership on the City Planning Commission, and his city park commissionership brought the number to 9, but more power. And it was demonstrated most convincingly by O'Dwyer's acceptance of Moses' philosophy. Listening to the mayor's first annual message to the city council on January 9, 1946, Jack Lutsky was convinced that while the voice might have been the voice of Billow, the hand was the hand of Bob, particularly when O'Dwyer said, "It is impossible to satisfy everyone in a city as big as this. I welcome suggestions and help from all sources, groups, and individuals, but I do not intend to be swayed from the course which has been laid out simply because it does not have unanimous support, or because some toes are trodden on, or some vested interest of one kind or another disturbed. I hope I can proceed with a minimum of disturbance, but progress sometimes involves some temporary hardships." Moses emerges as strong man of the O'Dwyer administration, the Times headlined. Mr. Moses, nominally a Republican, is thus viewed as enjoying greater prestige in the O'Dwyer administration than he ever encountered in his long and varied political career, the Warren Moscow article stated. It has not caused much concern among the patronage-minded in political circles because Mr. Moses is known to be definitely a policy man, without concern in building up a personal political organization, and because he is an independent with a personal fortune that eliminated gain as a possible motive. LaGuardia, raging impotently over the airwaves, said that Moses had been made an Oberbürgermeister, a supermayor. Moses agreed with the Moscow and LaGuardia assessments. So confident was he of his hold over O'Dwyer, in fact, that he was unable to resist boasting about it publicly. "Sure, I'm a conservative. I believe in doing things the conservative way," he told a Christian Science Monitor reporter in May 1946. "The dreamers can't get things done. They can't begin to cope with the problems we have. The big prize here, of course, is O'Dwyer, but the mayor is able to take the pressure. I believe we have won. Last February, the radical side tried to get control, tried to use the mayor's brother Paul as a lever to swing the mayor. That force is still at work and is the main avenue through which the radicals would try to swing the city. It was a tough decision for the mayor. He had that family tie. It was a big temptation for him to waver toward the left, but after this initial indecision, he swung around. So euphoric was Moses that when a Post reporter told him that the interview made him look like the leader of a citywide right-wing movement, Moses only laughed and said, "You take the left wing, and I'll take the right wing." Believing he held the mayor in his palm, he tried to squeeze him. On May 29th, a memo from a mayoral aide listing matters pending for O'Dwyer's decision included, should the housing program be put under Moses as coordinator? But Moses had badly underestimated the hardness under the easy Irish smile. Publicly, O'Dwyer laughed off the interview. But Moses' remarks had brought to a boil an Irish temper that had been simmering quietly for weeks. No dummy about bureaucratic maneuverings, he had begun to realize how cleverly he had been hemmed in with men whose first loyalty was not to him. Intellectually capable of grasping citywide problems on the broad scale, he had listened to Citizens Union and City Club deputations explain that the city was heading for disaster unless the burgeoning, surging growth now sweeping across the empty spaces of Middle Queens and the Upper Bronx and what was left of Brooklyn was shaped by a master plan. And the reports that were pouring daily onto his desk brought daily proof that men like Luther Gulick and Lawrence Orton were right. Moreover, no immense intellectual capacity was necessary to see that the problems Moses had promised him would be solved so quickly were not being solved at all. Always before, when Moses had stepped into a field, results had been quickly forthcoming. Now, months after Moses had accepted responsibility for the emergency housing of veterans, tens of thousands of veterans, more every week, were being forced to live with in-laws, to leave the city entirely, even to bivouac on the streets, because there was no place for them to live. Each weekend's traffic tie-up seemed longer than that of the week before. Stating in a speech that progress sometimes involves some temporary hardships was well and good, but some of the temporary hardships Moses was proposing to inflict were political suicide. Thousands, tens of thousands of families had to be evicted to create the right-of-way for Moses' giant expressways, and Moses was proposing to go ahead with the evictions immediately, to tear down tens of thousands of apartments during a desperate apartment shortage. Each Board of Estimate meeting was jammed with hundreds of protesters begging the board to stop the evictions, and these protesters spoke with a desperation new even to hardened BPs like Jimmy Lyons. Week after week, at these board meetings, O'Dwyer was forced into the position of defending policies about which, for political if not humanitarian reasons, he was beginning to have doubts. Spargo, trying as always to out Moses, began treating O'Dwyer as if he, too, had him in his palm. O'Dwyer fired him on the spot. Soon, City Hall was buzzing with reports that O'Dwyer was creating a troubleshooting squad, with broad authority, of men he knew to be loyal to him. Months earlier, Orton had asked the mayor for $250,000 to begin work on the master plan and a related revision of the zoning code. There had been no reply. Now, in late June or early July, O'Dwyer called back. The Board of Estimate, composed of men who had been listening to Moses' views for years, would not okay a large expenditure for the plan, he said. But, he added, I think I can get the money for zoning. Go ahead and make your arrangement. With Edwin Salmon replaced as chairman of the City Planning Commission by Robert F. Wagner, Jr., a rising young star in the Democratic Party, the zoning maps were formulated in a way in which they could form a detailed basis for a master plan. As soon as Moses realized what was going on, he fought every move to advance the zoning study. But he lost every vote, the first time he had been on the losing side of an issue since he had joined the commission. Burlingham and McCaney and Windles and Binger and Isaacs and other old giants of the city's reform movement called on O'Dwyer to express their appreciation, and to raise again the question of the old fort at the Battery, and to assure the mayor that Moses was lying when he said that it could not be restored. They could stop worrying, O'Dwyer told them. They had asked him to stop Moses by ceding the fort to the Department of the Interior. Well, he was prepared to do just that. It was on Idlewild that the mayor's boiling temper boiled over. Of all Moses' suggestions, that one had backfired most badly, and, for the mayor, most embarrassingly. Lulled by Moses' assurances that creation of an authority would end airport financing problems, O'Dwyer had publicly announced that he had saved New York from the Port Authority and Jersey politics. But Moses had planned to make the bonds attractive to investors by raising, by as much as 600%, the airline's rentals for hangar and terminal space. And the airlines, still struggling financially to get off the ground, said they could not afford to pay what Moses asked, and pointed out that they saw no reason why they should, since the old rentals were guaranteed them by contracts they had previously signed with the city. They were willing to renegotiate the rentals, they said, but not to levels anywhere near those Moses was demanding. Over lunch at Randall's Island, Moses, threatening that the city would sue to break the contracts, and pointing out that the suits could drag on for years, depriving the airlines of any landing area in the country's greatest metropolis, except for old and antiquated Newark Airport, alternately cajoled and bullied the executives, until Eddie Rickenbacker, the World War II air hero who had become president of Eastern Airlines, said curtly, "I'm going to Newark," grabbed his coat and hat, and walked out. Moses had to report to O'Dwyer that the bonds could not be sold. And at this crucial point, the Port Authority exerted a crucial bit of pressure, announcing that it would begin immediately a $75 million enlargement that would make Newark Airport the finest in the world. The city's press, already attacking O'Dwyer for the giveaway to the bankers, accused him of having surrendered the supremacy in aviation essential to the city's future. Removing the city's airport program from Moses' hands, the mayor turned over Idlewild and LaGuardia to the Port Authority. The authority promptly canceled an Idlewild design contract that would have given an architectural firm selected by Moses a fee of $1,178,250. While Moses' popularity was still overwhelming, it had developed significant gaps on the left. During the same week in which he suffered the Idlewild defeat and was watching the City Planning Commission slip out of his hands, a committee of liberal organizations was formed with the avowed purpose of forcing O'Dwyer to remove him from office, and 300 delegates representing 28,000 city and state employees supported that demand in a resolution calling him an anti-democratic reactionary, and assailing him for cutting the school building program and for favoring discrimination in low-cost housing and in employment. On July 28th, PM could report that the biggest story in the city government today is the apparent decline of Robert Moses as the power behind the throne. And on August 12th, the capstone was put on the pyramid of Moses' defeats when President Truman, after checking with O'Dwyer and being told flatly by the mayor that Fort Clinton should be preserved and restored as a national monument, signed a bill passed by Congress authorizing the Department of the Interior to do so. There were several pointed private developments. Moses heard no more about his suggestion, which O'Dwyer had seemed on the verge of accepting, that General Farrell be appointed chairman of the Housing Authority. He did hear that O'Dwyer was considering enlarging the membership of the City Planning Commission to reduce Moses' influence over it. Most significantly of all, Moses' access to O'Dwyer was restricted, if not in fact all but eliminated. The days of the two-hour chats in which he could swing the mayor were over. Soon City Hall was abuzz with rumors that he was having difficulty even getting in to see the mayor. Once, attempting to arrange a personal interview with O'Dwyer, Moses used the ploy of asking a deputy mayor to remind his boss that a city program should be agreed upon before the 1947 legislative session, and to ask him to appoint and to meet with a committee of key city officials, including the city construction coordinator, to do so. There was no reply. Moses was reduced to inviting a lower echelon mayoral assistant, legal aide Harold L. Herzstein, to lunch in an attempt to win the mayor's ear for the proposal. And the reply from Herzstein, when it came, came in writing and reflected the mayor's coldness, as well as a desire to return power in the city to the traditional repositories of power. The mayor is aware of the necessity for the city's formulation of a program. He has a program in mind, which he will submit informally to the members of the Board of Estimate for their approval. When he obtains such approval, he will consider the selection of the personnel to effectuate his program in Albany. During this period, even Moses' ultimate weapon failed him, for the first time in decades. A Triborough messenger showed up at Gracie Mansion one day with a letter of resignation from Moses. The mayor handed it back to the messenger and told him, "Tell the gentleman who sent this that if he wants me to accept it, just send it back again." The messenger did not return. But Moses used the power of money to bring the mayor to heel. O'Dwyer was desperate for money. The city's crises were worsening. Press and public wanted action. He was, moreover, in the midst of a struggle to take over Tammany Hall, a struggle which revolved around his attempts to oust Manhattan Borough President Hugo E. Rogers, whose office was a particularly lucrative source of contracts for the machine. He was not unaware, moreover, of the fact that any major public works projects which were not started almost at once would not be finished when he ran for re-election in 1949. His city, his grasp for party power, his personal career, all these required money, and he didn't have any. Action in the housing crisis was conceived of by press and public as construction of new housing. New housing projects had been planned with the state money Moses had obtained, but the very crisis that made construction imperative, the lack of vacant livable apartments in the city, made construction difficult, because there were no apartments into which to relocate families living on the sites on which planned housing was to be built. The state had agreed to pay $3 million to rehabilitate vacant, boarded-up tenements for the temporary use of such families if the city housing authority would also contribute $3 million. But while the clamor of the citizenry for housing action mounted daily, the city was unable, month after month, to come up with its $3 million. Whether or not, after O'Dwyer's attempt to discipline him, an attempt which included barring him from housing decisions, Moses quietly used his influence with state officials to discipline O'Dwyer instead and force the mayor to put him into the housing picture cannot be documented. But during the month of September 1946, the following sequence of events occurred. O'Dwyer agreed not to bring to a secret meeting with state housing officials any members of the city housing authority, but to bring Robert Moses instead. At the secret meeting, the state officials agreed to do what they previously refused to do, to pay the whole $6 million themselves. The official announcement of the agreement put out by the state officials said that the agreement had been accepted on behalf of the city by Robert Moses and Mayor William O'Dwyer, and some informed insiders believed it was no accident at all whose name came first. Action in the traffic crisis was conceived of by press and public as construction of highways and giant off-street parking garages. The city had no money for garages. The only possible source of funds was Triborough, Robert Moses Triborough. In the first flush of his friendliness, O'Dwyer had appointed him for another six-year term. At O'Dwyer's request, he had agreed to spend $40 million building 16 of them, getting back the money from fees paid by garage users. State and federal money was available for highways, but Moses' hand was on the valves that regulated the flow of state and federal money into the city. State and federal governments, moreover, were forbidden by law to acquire the right-of-way without which the construction of highways could not start. Available city funds for right-of-way were clearly insufficient. A Triborough contribution was necessary. Moses had promised O'Dwyer such a contribution of at least $11 million during the next 3 years, as well as additional contributions amounting to perhaps another $20 million for planning and, on some stretches, actual construction to further speed his highway program. Whether or not Moses told O'Dwyer after the mayor's attempt to discipline him that he was no longer prepared to make contributions for highway right-of-way, planning and construction, and whether or not he quietly used his influence with the state DPW to delay the awarding of construction contracts cannot be documented, but during the last 6 months of 1946, the months of antagonism between Moses and O'Dwyer, there was a noticeable falling off in such awards, and a noticeable slowing down in the construction of highways in the city, to a point where press and public began to complain bitterly about the lack of action. More pointed were the developments in relation to the giant expressways which Moses had long been planning to construct across Manhattan Island itself. Even before the war, Moses had planned at least three such expressways, all elevated. An Upper Manhattan Expressway at approximately 125th Street, a Mid-Manhattan Elevated Expressway across either 30th or 36th Street, and a Lower Manhattan Expressway that would run across Broome Street and connect the Holland Tunnel with the Williamsburg and Manhattan bridges. Of the three expressways, the Mid-Manhattan would be by far the most spectacular, planned to run at a height of about 100 feet above the busiest streets in the world, through a forest of skyscrapers, and it had captured O'Dwyer's fancy completely. Hardly had Moses explained it to him when he was talking enthusiastically, in private, so as not to offend sooner than necessary the powerful real estate interests involved, about a highway from the Hudson to the East River through the 6th or 7th floor of the Empire State Building. Such a highway would, of course, be almost incredibly expensive. Moses' public estimate was $43 million, at least half of which would be for the condemnation of land occupied by skyscrapers. But Moses had told the mayor that if it could be a toll road, Triborough would build it for him. O'Dwyer had agreed, and, although funds were not immediately available, planning was already underway on Randall's Island and at the giant engineering firms that operated on Moses' orders. Certainly the mayor had expected that, of the three cross-Manhattan expressways, the Mid-Manhattan would be built first, and he had expected that, when it was built, he would be identified with its building. But on October 14th, to O'Dwyer's surprise, Moses and Borough President Rogers issued a joint announcement that studies had been underway for months on the Lower Manhattan Expressway, that a route had been finalized, that it had been incorporated in the federal and state highway systems as eligible for future state and federal highway funds, that preliminary plans, directed by the Office of the President of the Borough of Manhattan, are already underway by engineering firms, including Madigan Highland, that final plans will follow as soon as all those whose approval is required have given it, and that it is intended that land shall be acquired and construction started in 1948, and that this crossing shall be completed in 1949. The announcement was more a pressure tactic aimed at O'Dwyer than a detailed highway plan. The Moses-produced brochure that accompanied the announcement bore uncharacteristic marks of haste, but the pressure involved was heavy indeed. O'Dwyer could hardly miss the hints contained in the fact that Rogers' name and not his was attached to the announcement, and that it was not the mayor but the borough president who was directing the preliminary planning. Completion of the expressway in 1949, he must have realized, would make it the only major highway completed during his term, and it would be a highway identified with one of his opponents, a highway for which the contracts, with all the millions of dollars in patronage and political contributions such contracts entailed, would be distributed not by him, but by the organization he was fighting. And given the public demand for traffic action, a demand emphasized by the instantaneous press enthusiasm for a proposal that could be completed in 1949, opposing the highway was politically unfeasible. More pressure was applied on December 2nd. Prodded by O'Dwyer and Lazarus Joseph, and by the protests of school-conscious parents' organizations, the Board of Estimate on that date was meeting an executive session on the second floor of City Hall. Moses was present, but the board nonetheless shifted more than $21 million in the Moses-dominated Planning Commission's proposed 1947 capital budget from highways to schools. No details of the 5-hour session were available, the Herald Tribune reported, but there were clues to give color to reports that Mr. Moses found the going pretty rough. These hints came from the mayor. The Citizens Union rejoiced that